Chicago.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave Free, and I'm an alcoholic. By the grace of God and the fellowship of AA, I haven't found it necessary to take a drink since December 23rd, 1967. So I've been sober over half my life, and that's pretty good for me. All you need to do is look at me. I've been somewhere for a long time, you know. I'm a reasonably happy man, and I got that way entirely in AA. And then the other point of view is that, you know, I'd have died a long time ago if I hadn't come to AA and stopped drinking. But, you know, the denial system was going crazy with me. My wife had been leaving AA stuff around the house. And, of course, I would take it and put it in the trash, never read it. I never saw the Days of Wine and Roses. I didn't want to see that. And I didn't. There was another one, Lost Weekend, was an old movie. And I didn't want to look at that. Didn't want to check anything to do with, you know, I might have a problem. I didn't look at myself at all. And on the 23rd of December, I woke up at home, and my family was missing. I was a daily whiskey drinker who went on binges, and I was just coming off a binge. And I was put out that they weren't there because I wanted them to go with me to the interment of a friend of mine who I served with in the Korean War. He was going to be buried in St. Mary's Church in Fairfax Station, if you're familiar with that. And that's a historic church. Clara Barton, I think, made herself famous there during the Civil War. I was upset about that, and but I went to the funeral. What was it, really a funeral, or was it just an interment? I waited for the ABC store to open for the first time in my life on December 23rd, 1967. I had looked around the house and I drank wine and everything else, and there was about that much of Southern Comfort there, so I drank the rest of that. And not wanting to get drunk, I was legally drunk all the time, I got a big bottle of, and I think it was a quart, of Southern Comfort, which pretty sweet stuff, you know. And that's what I went out on. I drank a lot. I was very drunk when I got to the graveyard. And I had this white raincoat on. It was December. And it had either thawed, frozen and thawed, or it rained. And the soil you call around here, you know, it's really clay. It was very slippery, and I slid down with one leg into that hole. Where the casket was, I'm hanging on. And my raincoat is getting redder and redder with that great soil. They pulled me out. And nobody wanted me to drive home. Let me drive, you know. But when I drank, I drove. I didn't want to admit I couldn't. Anyway, I was going down Route 23 towards Fairfax, and I looked off to my left, and they had just built a brand new police station there, police headquarters. And so I said, I don't have to go in there and report my family missing. And when I did, they locked my ass up for being drunk in public. By the way, I did send a Christmas card to the arresting officer a year later. I had my last drink, and I didn't know it was going to be my last drink, from a bottle under the seat on the way home when they finally let me out. And I made a phone call to my wife, and she came and paid my bail, I guess it was, or whatever it was, and exacted the promise that I would go to AA and get sober. Well, I really just lied, you know. Anyway, on the way home, I had my last drink, and then on the 24th, I was pretty sick, and so Marilyn gave me a pass on the 24th. And on the 25th, I came down, and there's a nicely decorated tree with pretty presents wrapped nicely, you know, under the tree. Some of them from Dad to the kids. Whew. And, you know, even in my anesthetized state, I had a conscience, but I still was in this denial thing. There's something going on. Anyway, right after dinner, a light came on. I said, boy, I ought to call AA today, Christmas Day, because they'll be closed. And somebody answered the phone. And isn't it great that AA is available on holidays, rainy days, all kinds of days? I remember later on, when just to go back a little bit, Bill Fuchs, that name ever ring a bell with you? No? He and I were good buddies. He had 9 more days of sobriety than me, never let me forget it. And so anyway, it had snowed, and we had started a meeting in Centerville. And the reason I'm telling this is about the AA thing, you know, and being available. And we figured it was really not a good idea to drive our cars. So we carried the water, because they didn't have any water. They had an outhouse in the back and everything. And we carried water, made coffee. And about 15 minutes later, we were just chatting around. And he said, we want to go home. And a new guy came in. So, you know, AA really should be and is available all the time. They have some sort of a statement somewhere about, and for this I am responsible. We want the hand of AA always to be there for this. And that's the reason, I guess, really, that I ever got sober. Anyway, they couldn't find anybody to take me. So they said, my first meeting was at the Falls Church City Group. And that was held in the Episcopal Church there where Washington would stop on his way to the Falls. Hence the name of the town, Falls Church. And I was about 3 blocks from there. It's dark, of course. And the meetings are at 8:30 there, start at 8:30. And I stopped at this motel for directions. And it was only 3 blocks away. And I got, and then I came back, and I said, could you tell me that again? Finally, they wrote it down on some of their stationery and gave it to me, and I found the meeting. I don't know how many weeks later, Marilyn found it in my pocket, and here's this thing in the motel, you know. And she, you know, she spoke to me about it, and anyway, I told her what it was, and she believed me because there hadn't been any action at our house for a long time. It was a speaker meeting, and there was a whole bunch of people. I think there were 7 or 8 people celebrating their anniversary. And they all get up there, and each one of them give a little synopsis of their life. And the only one that I related to was a woman. I immediately doubted my manhood. And I didn't like it. I was headed for the door, and a tall electrician named Bill Westmoreland. God bless him. Steve Brandt, who lives near here, he lives in Fluvanna County, but he has a summer home down in Florida. He called me last night and said that he was giving Bill Westmoreland his 52nd anniversary chip. And so he stopped and talked to me, and all I want to do is get out of there. And so I just promised to meet him in a meeting the following night with no intentions of going, just get rid of this guy. And so I did. Then the next day, I began to think that, in my hazy thinking, that Bill might get drunk, you know. I could see that he really needed AA. And he might get drunk if I don't show up. So I went to my second meeting, my first 12-step. And I was beginning to shake, by the way. I was really in bad shape, but I'll go into that. And at that meeting, the Fairfax group, it was a discussion meeting, and everybody introducing themselves. I'm Harry, I'm so-and-so, I'm an alcoholic. Came around to me and I said, I'm Dave, and I choke on the word alcoholic. I had an erroneous opinion of alcoholics, I guess. To me, an alcoholic at that point in my life was a guy named Fay McGee, and he was the town drunk where I grew up. And a little town of 300 people in Pennsylvania. And Fay didn't have a regular job. He didn't wash often. You found him in odd places in the morning. And I listened to my parents talking, and he was a town drunk, and they were always talking down about him. And I got the idea that Fay was some sort of a subspecies that, didn't deserve any consideration. And Danny Dunham, my good buddy at that time, he's deceased now too, we thought it was funny to light matches in Fay's shoes and then watch him jump a little bit, you know. He'd twitch. He wouldn't wake up, or he didn't. Only did it one time, but I can remember it. And we thought that was funny, and it was okay to do. And because of the notion that I got from my parents and grandparents, whether or not they talked that way, that's the way I received it, you know. And what I didn't realize then was that I was going to grow up and be another Fay McGee with a little different financial strait. Well, anyway, on Christmas Day, I get to the meeting, and I didn't see any guys with long overcoats and brown bags. They were really nice-looking people, you know. That second meeting, and that's where I fell in love with the people in AA. And, you know, I have never lost the love that I have for the people in AA. Never. I know the cynics say that if you love everybody in AA, you're not going to enough meetings. But I'm telling you, I don't know how many meetings, but well over 6,000 meetings, I'm sure. And I love everybody in AA, even if I don't know them. The minute somebody says they're an alcoholic, I know a lot about them right away. Maybe not the details, but I know a lot about them. Anyway, I was going to try and keep it light tonight. There's a part in the big book that says we're not a glum lot. And, you know, I've gotten laughs already, which is great. When I first came to AA, I was surprised at the laughter because it seemed to be you'd tell one disastrous thing after another and everybody'd laugh like hell. Well, and I've been sober a long time now, but I want you to know that the Dave Free who used to drink will drink again. He will. Only I'm not that Dave Free anymore. I changed. I remember when I first saw the 12 steps here, I said, what the hell has that got to do with not drinking? You know? And, of course, it has everything to do with not drinking. One of the things that was that I never learned from my experiences when drinking. And that was the insanity of my drinking. I would, you know, get in real trouble, have one disastrous drinking episode after another, and go right back to drinking. And anyway, I never learned to, take into consideration the consequences, I guess. Which reminds me of a little, he used to tell the story about James Forrestal, who was the former Secretary of the Navy. And when he was a budding young attorney, he was working in a very prestigious firm. And the head of the firm was a renowned lawyer of some sort. I don't really, I can't remember what it was, but and he was with him in his office one day, and he asked the great one. He says, "To what do you owe your very great success?" And he immediately said, "Experience." Oh, making the right decisions, excuse me. Making the right decision. I knew I couldn't tell that right. And so then he said, and how did you get, how were you able to do that? And then he said, experience. And he says, and how did you get the experience? He says, making the wrong decisions. And, you know, I did that, but I never learned. Never learned. I like drunk jokes. There's a story about a gal who was on a lunch hour from work, and she went into this little place and grabbed a sandwich and a martini. And as she was sipping her martini, a little old lady, a prim old lady over here, she said, "I would rather commit adultery than to drink that poison." And the girl said, "I would too, but I only got 30 minutes for lunch." All right. That's almost as good as, W.C. Field? When he said, "A woman drove me to drink and I didn't even have the decency to thank her." Okay, let's get back to it. I got hung up at almost every step. I don't know if I would have asked somebody to be a sponsor or not. I think along about my second month, and now I was saying I'm day free, I'm an alcoholic, because I heard a little from this one, a little from that one. I said, I've done that, or it's happened to me. And I began to realize, you know, if they're one, so am I. And a guy named Lou Sherwood, he was the founder of the Fairfax Group, one of the founders. And he came up and said he was going to be my sponsor. And Lou saved my life a couple of times. I'm not sure I would have made it without him. He had a way of cutting through all of the confusion I wanted to put into it. And this is a simple program. Not easy, but it's simple. And whatever I thought or did or wanted to do was probably the wrong thing. And I checked out everything with Lou after that. And he guided me through the steps. I know that I got to the third step and I said, I can't do it. I can't go any further. He said, why not? I said, I don't have a God of my understanding. He said, take a look at the 11th step. And it begins, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. He says, keep going. The proof of the pudding will be in how well you do with the rest of the steps, you know. So here I was without a real grasp. And by the way, he had told me to get down on my knees alongside my bed every day and pray. You know, I can remember the first time I did it. It was a Sunday and after dinner, nice day out and everything. I went in the bedroom, I shut the door, and I got down on my knees, and I was embarrassed. I said, what the hell am I doing here, you know? I mean, I did some talking. And I'll say it with this, that I would get a relief from saying the serenity prayer. All I needed to do was start. Yeah, God grant me the serenity to accept the thing. And I'll immediately start to feel better. And I don't know what that was all about, but I'm not a church goer, but AA is my church. I do have a higher power. I don't always have a conscious contact, but I have had it. I do comprehend the word serenity. All of the things that they say are going to happen in the promises have happened to me, one way or another. We got to the fourth step. Well, I took accounting in college, you know. And I said, well, I don't understand this, you know. And so he said, well, he said, ever done anything that bothers you? I said, well, sure, write it down. So I'd start to write down some episode, and I'd say, that isn't what happened. That's the story I invented for public consumption, you know, to explain away a black eye or something after COVID. And, you know, after a while, this happened every time, you know. And I wonder, what the hell else am I going to find out about Dave Freed that isn't true? And I was such a phony son of a gun. Anyway, that got me down, really. And I had quite a lengthy written, you know, thing on the fourth step. And then Lou, that was another thing. We carpooled a lot in those days. It was up in Northern Virginia. I don't know how many meetings they had, and there were thousands up there then, but then it was probably a dozen, maybe less. And we would carpool, and these guys were talking about they put down their assets, too. So I go to Lou, and I says, hey, you know, I got all this stuff here, you know, done. And I said, should I put down my assets, too? He says, are your assets bothering you? And I said, no. He says, then keep with the stuffy. Anyway, that's the way it went. The great thing was that the fifth step, it wasn't just a regurgitation, endless regurgitation of my fourth step inventory. Lou chimed in, too. It wasn't a who can top this kind of thing. It was kind of, there were two things I was never going to tell anybody. Then Lou said something. And, you know, I had him on this pedestal. And he there's no denying he's a great citizen, a good family man, honest, you know, everything, you all the qualities you want in a good person. And anyway, he didn't get down in my book at all, but I just said, gee whiz. And when he said those things, I blurted out my two secrets. And I'm really glad that I did. Because I believe that our secrets can keep us drunk. And hopefully whatever you're looking at is the real Dave Free, which is odd because I work for an organization. I retired from an organization where I had three identities. I had an alias, I had a pseudonym for anything in print, and then, of course, true name. And one of the interesting things that happened a lot would be you go to a cocktail party, and whether or not I was drinking by that time, I don't know. So 2 years into my employment with the Central Intelligence Agency, I stopped drinking. And I stopped drinking with a group that really believed that if you don't drink and drink a lot, you're in the wrong business. And I had arrangements with bartenders, you know, and don't make it too sweet, I'll get sick, you know. And they'd all say, the usual, Mr. Free? I said, yeah, you know. And so I became a closet teetotaler, if you can believe that. my cover job was the military sea lift command, which was part of the Department of Navy, primarily a civilian outfit. But the Navy was in charge, had a couple of admirals and captains and all, commanders. And basically, we were the history, you know. We knew what had gone before and all this kind of stuff. But anyway, with the passage of the Hughes Act, I don't know how many are familiar with that, Public Law 91616, Senator Hughes had been a three-time governor of Iowa, and prior to that he'd been a truck driver, and he got sober, and then he got to be this, and then he became a senator in the U.S. Senate. And he and several other very prominent citizens who were in AA broke their anonymity and testified before Congress to get this Hughes Act passed, Public Law 91616. What it did was it mandated that all government agencies start programs for their employees that were having problems with alcohol. Now, this is Nixon signed it into law on New Year's Eve in 1973. So in 73, I waited and waited for Bupers to come out with something. And what had happened was that I had testified before a group that was going to write the directive to implement that law. And then they asked me to be part of it, and I was. I helped in the writing of the directive. Anyway, I waited for Bupers to come out with an instruction. And when they didn't, I said, oh, I know as much as they do. So I wrote the first program for civilians in the Department of Navy. And one of the big things was that it changed the policy of the Navy. The Navy, the blue suit side, the active duty military side, had an alcohol effort dating back to 1965. But they had never administered to any civilians working with them. So the policy statement then was changed that if the predominant population was civilian, then the civilian program would administer to the blue suits. And if it was the other way around, then they'd administer to the civilians. And that would get everybody covered. That worked out pretty well. That first effort was strictly alcohol. Then they passed another law to do with drugs, and it became an alcohol and drug program. And then I took it all the way to what they call an employee assistance program. And I did this on my spare time. Nobody else wanted to do it, because I was interested, you know, I was able to do it. Anyway, the agency became aware of it. I know I was called in and talked to. In 1978, I started the program for the Central Intelligence Agency. And I ran that for 4 years before going back to my regular division. I'm just saying that a lot of stuff was done on the outside. Like up in Fairfax, a group of us got together. We coughed up the money, got a guy who was a grant writer, and we started getting some of that money on alcohol that was available. And we called ourselves CASI, the Council on Alcoholism for Fairfax County. And it went initially from just an alcohol awareness thing, education, to actual treatment. And as the federal money declined after a certain point, I forget what it was, maybe 5 years, started to decline, Fairfax County started to increase. And whatever they have up there now started with CASI. And that was way back in 1973. Another thing that we did, and Lee was talking to me about when he was living elsewhere, had the supervisory form of government, and we got started another thing called the Fairfax County Alcohol Advisory Council. And we assigned a good solid AA member to every supervisor. And when all the stuff was coming out of D.C., you know, this new stuff about alcohol, they said, no, that's not good. Do this, you know. And that was really that's good. ASAP started then. I even taught some of those classes early on. You know, anyway, that AA goes outside, too, you know. One of the big things in my life was a really uncontrollable temper. I grew up in kind of a tough neighborhood, I guess, and I remember I had fist fights, I guess, almost every day, it seemed. My father taught me how to box when I was only 5 or 6 years old, you know, I could usually handle the guys because nobody had ever seen a left jab, you know. Bang, it's right there. It's probably swinging it around. And then I was, you know, kids, once there's a bloody nose, you become friends again. I went through life that way. Joined the Marine Corps. I want to be a tough guy. Inside, I felt like a sissy. And that I didn't measure up. That took me really all the way with my drinking to go with the agency. Dealing with anger or solving everything with fights, you know. I remember, just to give an example, there was a place I used to frequent, a very nice little cocktail lounge. And it was at a motel, and people stayed overnight, you know, travelers, and they would come to this place. And anyway, I got talking to some guy, and we got into an argument. And here's the way I was. I said, "You want to fight?" He said, "What? I said, you want to fight?" He said, "No." I said, "Oh, then shut the hell up." And I won that argument, you know. And then he went away. I just imagine what a, you know, who is this crazy nut? I want to tell you another thing here about a guy who went to, this is that disease that tells you you don't have it, you know, the denial. This has to do with denial. The story goes that this guy goes to a psychiatrist and tells him that he's dead. And he says, "You're dead." He says, "Yeah." He saw him 3 or 4 times and tried to talk him out of it and couldn't do it. So he finally dreamed up an idea. He says, "I want you to go home and make up an appointment for 30 days from now. Every day, every morning, when you get up in the morning, you look in the mirror and say, 'I am not dead.'" And so the guy did that. He apparently, 30 days later, he says, "You still think you're dead?" "Oh, yeah, I'm dead." So he says, "Okay, give me your finger." And he pricked his finger and a drop of blood came out. And the guy says, "Gee, dead men do bleed." That's kind of like we were, only dumber maybe. Let's see what I got here. Clarence Snyder was an early member. I don't know if he was fifth man in AA or something like that. And when I was quite new, I was down at the Blackstone Retreat. And he was the Sunday morning speaker. And he began his talk by raising his hand and saying, "They say the Jews are the chosen people." He says, "Don't you believe it, unless he's a Jew in AA." And, you know, I have that feeling. We're chosen people, I truly believe. My God. You know, where are we going? When I look back, we're not to regret the past, nor wish to shut the door. All the things that I did, I'm so thankful that they weren't worse. You know, and the time wasted and everything else, you know. And I meet AA people and, well, I used to say they're the kind of people I'd like to drink with, but I don't know how safe that would have been. Yeah. I don't know. I haven't talked for a long time. Everybody knows the cucumber story. Anybody new hadn't heard that? Oh, yeah? Well, it goes like this. If you take a cucumber and you put it in some brine, at some magical point, it becomes a pickle. And the important thing there is that it'll never be a cucumber again. And alcohol is the same way, alcoholism. And you got it, you're going to keep it one way or another. No, I'm just in remission, I guess they call it now. Can't think of it. There's so many things I could say. And I can't think of anything else. I guess I'm not a good speaker, but Anyway, I certainly appreciate the invitation, Sam. I meant to start that way, that I appreciated you asking me, especially since you had me here back in 2009, and you asked me back. And I said, I hope this one will be better than the other one. One thing's for sure, probably shorter. Thank you.